We go to Mars tonight, accompanying the NASA program and the various landings and the orbiters that came before the landings, and a general report on what has been accomplished in the exploration of Mars and what yet remains to be done and is in the planning. My guests are two of the three authors of a very valuable and totally entertaining and informative new book titled Going to Mars, the stories of the people behind NASA's Mars missions, past, present, and future. And those two guests, they happen to be married to one another, are Judith and Garfield Reeves-Stevens, Reeves-Stevens. So you've done that modern thing, that sort of feminist-induced thing, and you've combined your two separate names into one hyphenated name.
We have indeed. And I got top billing.
Well, the woman usually comes first in that arrangement.
I think so.
So you were Reeves, and you were Stevens.
I was. And being Judith, I'm also ahead of Garfield.
Yeah. Now you're both Reeves-Stevenses.
Exactly.
Now you are very much engaged in the art of science fiction. You've done a good deal of science fiction by way of science fiction novels, science fiction movie scenarios, mm-hmm. television scenarios. Mm-hmm. You've had a close identity, I am telling our audience, I think you probably remember this, with the most recent version of the Starship Enterprise.
Yep.
But now you have been drawn in to doing a major book, a popular book, but very responsible one, scientifically undoubtedly up to date, with an important person at Jet Propulsion Laboratories, Brian Weirhead, and the three of you are the authors of this excellent new book, Going to Mars, into which we're going to dip almost instantly. But who is your co-author?
Our co-author, Brian Muirhead, began in our existence with him as the flight systems manager on Pathfinder, and he's the one that pulled together that wonderful team, and which was very idiosyncratic, very different, and he wanted to tell the story of it, and he drew us into it. And over the last 6 to 7 years, he's advanced to become the first chief engineer of JPL.
Mm-hmm. This is, of course, 2005. If we go back 100 years, to 1905. Weren't we still by that year more or less entranced with the likelihood or the recent discovery that there were intelligent creatures populating Mars?
Absolutely. That was, we always have to remember this, that we shouldn't laugh at what people used to think about Mars, because 100 years ago, it was reasonable to think that there might be at least life on Mars. There are patches on Mars that change color mm-hmm. according to the seasons. At the time, it was reasonable to think it was vegetation. Many astronomers claim to see these canals. And
Schiaparelli, the Italian, who called them, in Italian, canali, which doesn't quite mean canals, actually.
No, it means a river channel, something yeah. that was created naturally. But when it was translated into English, German, and French, the translation shifted the meaning to canal. The Suez Canal, of course, exactly. was the wonder of the age. And everybody thought, well, if they're canals, somebody had to have built them.
And that led shortly to that wonderful series of books by the man who wrote Tarzan, Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Yes.
What's the name of his character on Mars?
Oh, that was John Carter of
John
Mars.
John Carter of Mars.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were certainly fantasy at the time, because yeah. all John Carter needed to go to Mars was he just had to think about it, yeah. and he would go.
Well, that's still the real method of space exploration. Our mutual friend, we were talking about it before we came on the air, that is Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When he did his one science fiction novel.
Contact.
Contact.
That's right.
His way of doing it was essentially through thought.
Mm-hmm. Through thought, but
assisted by some very complex physical
and visually movie. Entertaining in the movie as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so that's what we thought in 1905.
Mm-hmm. And it was reasonable to think mm-hmm. that too.
When were we first disabused of that?
It was a gradual process. And that was one of the things that we found was really interesting, was to take the science fiction all through the 20th century mm-hmm. and place it in context and say, what did they know when? So that as you look at it, you realize what could be ruled out at the time and what had not been proved. And mm-hmm. frequently when people look back at science fiction, they don't see it that way. They're looking at it with today's eyes.
Well, no, I was going to say, it was gradual up to a point mm-hmm. Because what happened was astronomers thought they saw the canals. They saw these color changes that went according to the seasons. But as astronomy became more precise, they started to realize, well, the atmosphere is a bit thin, so how could anybody breathe it? Mm-hmm. And the temperatures are too extreme. And so by, let's say, the 1960s, we began to think, if there's life on Mars, it's probably vegetation, and really there can't be civilizations there that have built the canals. And then the gradual process changed instantly with the flyby of the Mariner 4 spacecraft in 1966. And that those 21 photographs, I think 19 of them are good, mm-hmm. That just astounded the world, because all of a sudden we saw craters on Mars. And we realized this was a dead planet. This, it had no heavy weather to talk about. There were no there was water channels evident, but they weren't the canals that were seen before. Mars was dead, and they measured the thickness of the atmosphere. Then they realized it was 1% of Earth's. Nothing could live there.
You say that water channels were evident. Is it by now among your scientific friends at NASA and at Jet Propulsion Lab, is it by now more or less commonly concluded that there has been water on Mars?
Yes, that's absolutely.
Because that's what the recent missions have been about,
yes.
To determine whether there ever was H2O on Mars.
Yep.
And it's fascinating to have gone from the canali to the action of water on Mars being proven. And now they're looking for water actually existing.
Rather than just signs of water once having
that's
been
right.
there.
Yeah.
And are our two very, very busy explorers finding evidence of water?
Oh yes. They were
they haven't stumbled into a pool of water yet.
Not yet. That will be difficult. There are only very extreme conditions on Mars. It would be summer in the Valles Marineris. Where if an astronaut poured out a bottle of water, where liquid water might exist on the surface for, a couple of minutes, a couple of hours. Pools of water could exist beneath the surface of Mars, and that's where the next round of exploration will go.
Now, it's commonly asserted, but I think it needs simple, basic explanation. The science needs to be laid out, if only in elementary terms. It is commonly asserted that life could not arise on Mars unless there had been water. Why is that the case?
Well, everything we know about life is that life as we know it, which is what NASA has to look for, mm-hmm. because nobody knows how to look for life not as we know it. So they say life as we know it requires water. Water is a necessary condition of life. Without water, we don't know how the processes of life can take place. And so rather than develop the instrumentation and the theories to look for life itself, which is very difficult, NASA has this gradual approach, this sort of stepladder. And the first thing is find water. Because if we hadn't found water at all, then there's no point looking for life.
But the key is the phrase you just used, life as we know it.
Yes.
And it has been argued and written by some that there may be life as we don't know it.
Oh,
on
absolutely.
A very different cycle, not on the carbon cycle, but on a silicon cycle or something like that, which would not necessarily require water.
There would probably have to be some sort of solvent. They were looking just at those wonderful photographs that came back from Titan, the moon of Jupiter, and the moon of Saturn. And what's so exciting about that is the processes on Titan resemble the processes on Earth, but at extremely low temperatures. And some of the scientists are thinking that, we have a solvent there in the liquid methane, liquid ethane. Could that give rise to a form of life? And that's something that a rover someday might discover for us.
A good part of your book is given over to the very interesting people at NASA, and more particularly at Jet Propulsion Laboratories, who've done so much to advance this work. They are our Mars explorers, though they have not yet themselves put their own human feet on Mars, though some of their successors, you are predicting, certainly will, and that within the next 30 or 40 years at the latest. We'll talk about all of that, but when we return right after some impending commercials, let's celebrate some of the men and women of NASA and of JPL as well, because that's what your book does, and they're some quite fascinating characters.
Oh, they
are. People of tremendous accomplishment. We return directly to the Reeves-Stevenses, co-authors of Going to Mars. That book, by the way, is just published by whom?
Simon Schuster Pocketbooks.
I've heard of them. And we'll be directly back after this. And we return to Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens, who, together with their co-author, namely Brian Muirhead, have just recently had published this excellent, superbly illustrated as well as very vividly written new book, Going to Mars, the stories of the people behind NASA's Mars missions, past, present and future. Let me give you a little epigraph for this particular portion of our program from Ray Bradbury, writing way back in 1971 in his book, Mars and the Mind of Man. And he says, I would not see our candle blown out in the wind. It is a small thing, this dear gift of life handed us mysteriously out of immensity. I would not have that gift expire. If I seem to be beating a dead horse again and again, I must protest. No, I am beating again and again living man, to keep him awake and to move his limbs and jump his mind. What's the use of looking at Mars through a telescope, sitting on panels, writing books, if it isn't to guarantee not just the survival of mankind, but mankind surviving forever? Bradbury agreed even that early with some others who were saying, we can't manage on this planet forever. The planet may well be destroyed within a foreseeable time. And if not, it will overload and overburden itself. Our destiny is to get out into space. And the first place to go, apparently, well, we've been to the moon. Maybe we can colonize the moon, but beyond that, the necessary location is Mars.
It's Mars. And the director of JPL, Charles Alachi, had some very far-reaching objectives in mind when he said the whole notion of being an explorer is to commit to lofty goals and that we're answering major questions. And he had four basic ones that really caught our attention and caught everyone's attention there when he said, who are we? Where did we come from? Are we alone? And what is our fate? And this is the manager of all the projects at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, coming from a scientific background but caught by some of the largest questions we can face as a species.
And definitely, what is our fate is the answer to that is one where Mars looms as an answer. Because if humans survive on Earth long enough, if we become another species, if we become a meld of machine and man, at some point, Earth will no longer support life. But when the time comes because of the swelling sun and the heating sun that Earth no longer supports life, Mars will once again be a warm planet. And perhaps in that time we can make it a wet planet again, give it an atmosphere, and that can become our home.
And that's coming soon, the swelling of the sun, just about 5 billion years from now.
Well, but the temperature, actually it's surprising. We're more than halfway through the sustainable period of life on Earth, because it's not so much that the sun will expand out to the size of Earth, it's just as the temperature increases. And it is humbling to think that we're in the second half of that.
But we've been here for about... The planet has been here for about 5 billion years.
Yep. Four and a half billion, and life almost as long. They feel that, this is why the search for life is so exciting on Mars, that they feel that as soon as Earth cooled down enough and stopped being hit by major asteroids, as soon as it cooled down enough for water to form, that's when life began, almost instantly.
But of course, the full vision for the far distant future of mankind is to persist as a living species is not merely to settle on Mars. Mars is a jumping off place.
That's
far
right.
Beyond.
That's right.
How far beyond is hard to conceive.
We're still in the midst of a human endeavor, and that's exploration.
Yeah.
And I think Carl Sagan, we were noting that he said that we come from hunter-gatherers and that we've always been wanderers, and the next place to wander is Mars. And I think scientists are caught by this as well, but even in the short term, they do have some goals. And one of them is we can't do all of our investigations of life and its origins on Earth. We have a very tumultuous history on Earth in terms of it's an active planet. Mars has been less active. And one of the things that's so exciting is that Mars could have a record of the emergence of life.
Yeah. But before we go there to answer those questions, before we land there and even try to colonize Mars, we need to scout out the terrain pretty closely.
Yeah.
And that's what the people you're reporting on have been doing for some time. Who are some of the main figures? What are some of the main accomplishments?
Well, we have to start, I think, with Brian Muirhead, our co-author, who worked as the flight systems manager on the Pathfinder mission, which put the Sojourner rover, that cute little rover we see every week in the opening credits of Star Trek Enterprise, on Mars. And what I think probably the most important thing the rovers have told us is that water played a part in the early history of Mars. And that opens the door. Once you check that off, once you say that water was on Mars, then the possibility exists that life formed there. And that's got to be the major. In fact, when the Mars Exploration Rover people made that announcement or got those findings, they all left JPL and they went to Washington to NASA headquarters to have the press conference. It was such a major announcement.
What are the dates on MER, Mars Exploration Rover?
They landed in, let's see, we saw them blast off in the summer of 2003, so that would be June and July, and then they arrived, I think Spirit arrived January 4th, 2004, and then toward the end of the month, Opportunity made that hole-in-one by landing in a crater with sedimentary rock.
And it was expected that they would last for 3 or 4 months, and they're,
yes,
they're about a year and a half old now and still going.
Well, that's right. What I loved was that Steve Squires, who was the principal investigator, mm-hmm, the chief scientist on this project, had a book contract that said that he had to deliver his manuscript 45 days after they stopped operating on the surface of Mars. They're still going. We're not sure if that's a good thing for him or not. But
was this just an odd turn of luck, or was the engineering that good?
The engineering was that good. These people, first of all, they had the ground truth from the Sojourner rover. They studied that. They knew how it had operated on Mars. It knew what temperatures it was facing, what the consistency of the Mars regolith was like, and they applied all that to the Mars Exploration Rovers. Stupendous engineering. Everybody expected that they would last longer than 90 days, but they figured maybe 10 months. I don't think anybody thought they'd still be operating after a year. And the most incredible thing is they figured that, well, they would slowly die as dust built up on the solar panels because they're powered by the sun's energy. But what was it? Spirit, which had been building up a huge thick pile of dust, and so that slowed down the amount of energy it had every day. It's just been through a major dust storm, and it's back to full power.
Does the public know the names, and for that matter, something of the history of the people to whom they are indebted on this project?
I don't think so, and I think that was one of the reasons that Brian wanted to do this kind of book. It
so
started
let's not
with
phrase famous men and women, or famous men and women deserving to be famous for these accomplishments.
I think that we found that when we went in to talk to them, that these people, we knew they were extraordinary, and we knew they were intelligent, we knew they were well-prepared, but we hadn't realized just how unusual they were and how unusual their journey was to the jobs that they now have. And I was thinking the day that we met Tom Rivellini, and he is the name behind Tommaso Rivellini. He is the young engineer behind the invention of the airbags, and the airbags were what protected the Pathfinder when it landed on the surface, and it's been used through the Mars exploration rovers as well, and it is now essentially the system that they're using. But Tom, who not only decided on the size, the shape, the number of layers of fabric, and how you would inflate them, Tom had begun working with this type of thing as a child when he had been just looking at wind tunnels, I remember, and NASCAR and model.
He was
Formula One racers.
And also, he told us that his parents would have to put their kitchen appliances up on high shelves because he could take them apart at the age of two, but couldn't put them back together again.
I believe that's where we came up with Mother's Hydro Blenders as a chapter title.
But Tom had this incredibly inventive mind. The airbag system was actually first used by the Soviet space program in landing Luna 9 on the moon, and this was the first time a probe successfully soft landed on a moon on another planet. And Tom and the engineers for the Pathfinder mission, they went back to this idea. They couldn't find a lot. The Russians weren't talking about this design, and they came up with a totally new one, which basically Tom put together with yarn and paper bags and glue and straw on his kitchen table.
Still a model maker. And he'd begun as a model maker as a child, mm-hmm, and this is he became an inventor.
Now, who's responsible for, or what group is responsible for the tremendous pinpointed accuracy of the landing targeting?
Oh, well, I think we'd have to give Rob Manning credit for that. And Rob is the fellow you see crying in the video footage. He's a big fellow with a beard and a Pathfinder and Mars Exploration Rover with a big smile. And Rob was the son of a Navy aviator, grew up on a farm, absolutely fascinated with flying and with radios and weather stations, and he couldn't afford to buy any of the parts for any of these things. So he took the books out of the library, and he learned all he could about flying, about building a radio. And in his mind, he built all these things, but he couldn't afford to put them together. He ended up going to a farm university,
yes,
and became a tractor, you know, learned tractor mechanics. And
well, what's the nature of the engineering achievement? How do you get that degree of accuracy in landing the explorer when you've already traversed what distance?
Oh boy,
it's
always changing, but it's over 200 million miles.
Yeah, it's rather a long way.
Oh,
and I loved, there was Robin Vaughn, who was a member of the Pathfinder navigation team, talked about it in terms of a golf game. And mm-hmm. the analogy was that Cape Canaveral was the tee, which was Pathfinder's launch
yeah.
site, and that the safe target area that it could go into would have about 26 mile diameter, and she called that the green. And the spacecraft could enter at the proper angle and speed, not be destroyed coming into this area. But there was only a 15-mile area in diameter that they would think of as the hole
yeah.
where it could land safely. And this was as if you teed off in Pasadena and landed in a 7-inch green circle of grass in Houston, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and dropped down into the hole, which was at 4 inches.
Yeah.
And the accuracy is incredible. And I think one of the things that we noticed with the team out at JPL for all of the projects is that they want the public to believe that they are, it's not an us and them, that they are an elite that should not be supported by public funds. They want people to feel that they are just like them, but they're not. And they also want people to realize just how hard it is. They're afraid they're making things look too easy.
Do you know when the spacecraft is any spacecraft is traveling from Earth to another planet, that it's not only the gravitational pull of the other planets and of the sun, it's not just the power that comes out of the rocket engines when they fire, but actually the impact of photons, of light from the sun, is enough to slightly push the spaceship off course. And they have to be, the precision is incredible because they have to allow for this, they have to calculate it. When they send a spacecraft on its way, they have the predicted trajectory, and then they have the real trajectory, and they have to figure out how to bring them together.
It would take some awfully good programming skills as well as a vast knowledge of physics and engineering to write the program for all of that, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. And,
and the staggering thing
art.
is that also I think we certainly thought as outsiders, not participants in the program, we hadn't realized how much is done after launch, where with Rob Manning,
right,
who's involved with software.
We can steer from the ground, you mean?
Yes. But when they launch the actual spacecraft, a lot of the software is not on board yet. And they send it to it during the cruise phase.
Mm-hmm.
And they're constantly changing and adapting that software and testing it as it goes along. So it's not cut and dried. Much happens after launch, and they will always encounter, as in any exploration venture, there will always be problems.
How much of this was done in interaction one way or another with the folks down the road at Livermore, where they are designing essentially nuclear weaponry and guidance systems for missiles?
Well, there's an interesting connection there because
there has to be an interactivity there.
There definitely is.
And it's amazing how far back it goes, because the heat mm-hmm. shield that protects the Mars Exploration Rovers and the Mars Pathfinder when they entered the Martian atmosphere at 12,000 miles per hour, that heat shield was based on mathematical models developed for the heat shield that protected the Apollo command module coming back from the moon. And that heat shield was based on studies that were done by Lawrence Livermore for the goal of protecting orbital nuclear weapons when they re-entered Earth to attack enemies.
That whole interaction begins, of course, with the Nazi bunch. It begins with Wernher von Braun at Peenemünde. When they designed the V-12, they, in fact, were laying the ground for the first rocket that we used to send a man up in space.
That's right, and that came down to the battle between the United States and Russia, where our Germans are better than your Germans.
Exactly. Yeah. And our commercials are 10 minutes late at the moment. Mm-hmm. We're going to pause for those. Then I think we need to look to the future. We need to talk about what they are planning and what... you've been in on some recent conferences as
yes.
creative people, assisting the people at JPL on thinking through the nature of future projects.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about those projects that are now being conceptualized,
mm-hmm.
that are now already to some degree planned. And we'll go directly to that with Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens after these words. And we return to Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens, who, together with Brian Weirhead, are the authors of this fine new book, Going to Mars: The Stories of the People Behind NASA's Mars Missions Past, present and future. And let us indeed talk about the future. What's the vision?
The vision at the moment, as laid out by President Bush's space initiative, involves going first to the moon and then going to Mars. And it's,
well, we've been to the moon.
But this time it's going to be used as a staging area.
And are we going to establish a sort of permanent installation, a manned presence on the moon?
The idea is to establish perhaps not something that's manned the way the ISS is manned on a 24-hour-a-day basis, 365 days a year, but certainly an outpost.
A pied-à-terre.
Yes, where you can visit
for
weekends.
That's right.
But a training area, staging area. There, that was a controversial choice for people who want to get to Mars and want to get to Mars now. Mm-hmm. But when you... When you go to the moon, you're only 3 days from home. If something goes wrong, you've got a pretty good chance of getting home. When you go to Mars, you're going to be gone for at least 3 years. And when something goes wrong, that's it. So
it's a safe staging area.
Yeah, to survive on Mars, it's going to help if the astronauts have trained on the moon. The technology should be proven on the moon. It's the whole idea of the vision for space exploration, which NASA is following now, is to go to Mars, which is the end goal, putting humans on Mars. That is the explicit goal that NASA is working toward. But the idea is to do it in a gradual, step-by-step process. There's still a lot of things we have to learn before we can go to Mars.
And there's technology that has to be developed as well before they can.
Well, then we already have the technology to get a vehicle to Mars and to get it safely landed. Mm-hmm. We just haven't put a man in that vehicle.
But we have to put a man, we have to put life support, we have to put radiation shielding. Mm-hmm. And the most important question to answer now is, if we breathe the dust of Mars, are we going to get miner's lung? There's strange chemistry in the Martian dust, and we have no idea how that will affect the biochemistry of the human body.
And the whole issue of planetary protection is becoming major now in terms of planetary protection of Mars and of Earth in terms
what
of what
might
we might
bring
back
from Mars.
That's
and
right.
What we might bring to what we might bring to Mars. Mm-hmm. Because if there is no life on Mars now, or if there never has been, there are conditions on Mars that there is bacteria and archaea on Earth that could survive under those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So it is plausible that we could bring something to Mars that would suddenly set up home there.
Well, with all of those complications in mind, what sort of target date roughly viewed are they thinking about?
Well, right, the next mission to Mars from NASA is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and that is actually at Kennedy Space Center now, and will launch this summer.
Not going to land; it's going to do another orbiting.
It's orbiting, but the optics it has are incredibly. This is part of that cross fertilization between the defense industry and NASA.
Sure.
And it's like the best spy satellites orbiting Earth. It will be able to photograph things the size of a dinner plate, and it will find Sojourner on Mars, and it will be looking for things like geothermal hot springs. It will be looking for water under the surface. It will be looking for landing sites.
So by the time that humans get there, they're going to know a great deal more than we know now about the surface.
Mars quite closely.
Intensely.
In detail. The next landing mission is the Mars Phoenix Lander, and that's going to launch in September 2007, arrive Mars April 2008. And this is going to land in the North Polar region of Mars, just on the fringes of it, where no ice exists. And it won't rove around, but it has a mechanical arm that can dig up to 3 feet down into the frozen ground. It's going to be looking specifically for ice, and it has the instrumentation on board to look for signs of biological activity. And NASA parses this very precisely. It's not looking for life, but it's looking for the waste products of life and the signs of life.
Well, that was the assigned task a long, long time ago. What was the first lander?
Viking 1 and Viking 2.
Back in the mid-1970s.
Yep, 1976.
Wasn't there an argument as to whether they had found evidence with some of those byproducts of life of life having existed?
And the fascinating part was that argument continued right until now. In
Is
terms
it still
of what,
ongoing?
Yep. Yes.
Yes.
Now, the majority of scientists, the majority of people who study Mars will say that what the Viking landers picked up in their life detection experiment is novel chemistry, a peculiar type of chemistry that exists on Mars that we aren't familiar with and weren't expecting, and so we couldn't design the instruments to filter it out. The designers of the life detection experiments, when they saw the chemical analysis reports come back from the Pathfinder rover and come back from the Mars exploration rovers, they're saying that chemistry can't be supported. We found life. And that's going to be, that's actually going to be a question that might be answered perhaps by the Mars Phoenix lander in 2008, but it could very well be answered by the most exciting rover going to Mars in 2009, the Mars Science Lab will launch. This will be the size of a Mini Cooper car. It will have life detection experiments specifically designed to find life, not just signs of life, that are a trillion times more sensitive than the ones on Viking. And though NASA downplays this, it's going to have what they call euphemistically a radioisotope power supply, which means it's nuclear powered. It's not going to have to be concerned about where the sun is, how much dust is building up on solar panels. It will be able to operate at least 2 years on Mars, travel miles, dig, drill, scratch. Microscopic imagers far better than the ones there. And it will have the instrument that will be able to determine if the methane that has been detected on Mars is biological in origin. And if it is, there's life on Mars.
And if there is life on Mars, what is the significance of that for our understanding of the nature of the universe?
Well, then we're two for two.
That's right.
Therefore, it must be everywhere.
That would be the implication.
But Sir Francis Crick put a yes but into that whole way of thinking some while ago, didn't he?
Well, the feeling
is... The panspermia hypothesis.
But then the question is... Now one
do first explain what that hypothesis is.
Panspermia is that life did not originate on Earth, but was seeded here. That life... and it's pretty clear that it can happen between Earth and Mars within our solar system, that bacteria is radiation-hardened, and it doesn't take as much energy as originally suspected for an asteroid impact to hit Mars, send a piece of Mars flying through space to land on Earth within a couple of hundred years.
Bringing life to
Earth. Bringing life. Mm-hmm. And fascinatingly...
So that our whole evolutionary history might have begun with a fragment that had been shipped off of Mars.
That's
I believe
right.
Matt Gollenbeck, the chief scientist who selected all sites on Mars for landings, always referred to us as Martians, saying we could be Martians.
Because the way the sun cooled and the planets formed, conditions on Mars for the creation of or for the emergence of life arrived half a billion years before they arrived on Earth. And so it's quite possible that if life arose on Mars first, that asteroid impacts and meteor impacts seeded Earth. And it will be to no one's great surprise if life is found on Mars and it is very similar to Earth.
So Francis Crick, who with Watson is, of course, the man who mapped the structure of DNA, hypothesizes, and I guess sort of half believes, that it may have gone just that way.
Yes. And now the other possibility, though, is that if we find life on Mars and it's similar to life on Earth, well, we still have to do a lot of work to determine, well, did it originate on Mars, come to Earth, originate on Earth, go to Mars?
Or did it come from a third source?
And all of those are so exciting because we have found hundreds of planets around other stars, and the feeling now is that more than half the stars we see have planets.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even have to be planets. It can be moons orbiting gas giants. And any place where there is water and sufficient time, it appears there's going to be life. Mars would be the proof of that.
We have the propulsion power, and the distance is short enough so that we can ultimately get human beings to Mars.
Yes.
And get them on the surface and get them profitably engaged in significant scientific labor for a few weeks before we fly them back home.
Yep.
It's even conceivable, I suppose, as Bradbury conceived it so many years ago in his book, The Martian Chronicles, that we can ultimately establish permanent installations on Mars, colonize Mars with human beings living there. They might ultimately, in a few millennia, develop their own brand of culture. And that might help in the further survival of the human species, because we've spread out a bit, but we're still just within our own teensy little solar system. How do we get out into the rest of the galaxy? Is it possible to even conceive getting beyond this galaxy into any one of the other 100 billion galaxies?
This is where we're finding the limits of human existence.
But you've worked on Starship Enterprise.
Every 2 years, yes. NASA has a little conference, doesn't cost a lot, called the Advanced Propulsion Committee or Conference, mm-hmm. and they actually sit down and they talk about warp drives, and they talk about zero-point energy, yeah. and they talk about all these things.
You've written scenarios for that sort of thing.
Oh, definitely.
For Starship Enterprise.
Enterprise travels by warp, so it's 4 days development.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
Which makes things a lot more convenient.
No one has ever been able. I've asked serious physicists and cosmologists, what exactly is space warp? And they laugh and say, well, that's the secret. We don't know. No.
Well, but actually, it's being defined by NASA now, mm-hmm. and it's being by NASA researchers, or people who contribute to these advanced propulsion discoveries. And there does appear to be wiggle room. Nobody knows what the power source would be, but definitely we know that space deforms because we live in an expanding universe. So that is a given. And the question is, can we affect that on a local area?
One science fiction dodge, as you know, you've probably written it more than once, is you jump into a black hole and come out at the other end of the universe.
A black hole, wormhole.
Wormholes. All
but
yes.
To open a wormhole and make it stable, you need something called negative energy. And that's a nice mathematical construct, but nobody knows exactly what
Seriously.
It is.
Seriously. Mais sérieusement. You're both Canadians.
Yes.
So we can do it that way. Is it conceivable at all that we can get beyond the solar system, or even to the edge of our own solar system, ever?
Absolutely.
I certainly think so.
Absolutely.
By what method of propulsion?
By what? Well, the fascinating
thing. I think
this
is where it moves into thought experiment. Uh-huh. If we can think about it, uh-huh. we're going to find a way to do it.
And also, let's just think about it, that here we are, barely 100 years from Kitty Hawk, and we've gone to Mars, and we've landed people on the moon. Where are we going to be 200 years from Kitty Hawk? Where are we going to be 500 years from Kitty Hawk?
My mother's grandmother used to tell her that she couldn't read Jules Verne and believe possibly that any of that would ever come true. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just moving very, very rapidly. And I think we've always felt that we can escape. And if only in stories at the beginning, it will become reality. And I think that there are scientists and engineers right now who are in grade 2 and in grade 3 reading science fiction and looking at the achievements of the people in the field today, and those are the people who are going to take us there.
Likely listening to us at this very moment.
We'd like to think so.
No, I'm going to tell you about somebody else. Probably listening to us at this very moment is my beloved grandson, Max, who's 8 years old and lives in Seattle. But I called his father earlier today and told him about this. Max is a great fan and a deep enthusiast for space exploration and for astronomy and cosmology and so on. We've had earnest discussions about the ultimate nature of the universe, and he knows a great deal. And he's very interested in this kind of material. Now, he's only 8, as I say.
I think that's
a
critical age. That is
the age that most
of the people we talked to at JPL were caught by what eventually became their careers.
But I'm wondering, when he's a mature man of 50 or 60, what will he... Even if he's not a participant in this, and he may well not be, I don't say that he's planning to be another space explorer, but what will he observe 50 years from now? What will have happened?
50 years from now, Max will see. He will have seen the first human landing on Mars and the return of the astronauts. Mm-hmm. He will, be, in 50 years, a permanent, at least one permanently manned or crewed scientific outpost on the moon.
And he perhaps on Mars. In 50 years.
In 50 years, permanently.
That will be his world,
yep.
is that we will be moving out of our solar system.
He will see telescopic arrays assembled in the Lagrange points, the point of gravitational stability in the Earth-Moon system, that have the resolving power to pick up continents on Earth-sized planets 20 light years away. Mm. He will know if those Earth-sized planets, and in fact, in 25 years, we will know if those Earth-sized planets have oxygen and methane in their atmosphere, and if they do, those are indicators that there is an ecosystem and there's life, because oxygen on a small planet is a byproduct of life.
Yes.
All these things are being planned now by NASA. All these things Max is definitely going to see.
I kind of wish I could be around to see it, too.
Well, the terrestrial planet finder is well within our horizon.
I think that's what Carl Sagan said, yeah, even when we got to Mars. Just remember that he'd be there with us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll all be with Max.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The prospects are really fascinating.
Oh, they are.
What does it cost? What's the budget for this sort of thing these days?
It's a fraction of what people believe it is.
Yeah.
Less than a penny of every tax dollar goes to NASA, and that employs thousands of people. It adds to, well, today we live in a space-based civilization, and that comes about from the space race of the 1960s. So to ask whether it's worthwhile spending money on space research today is like asking, is it worthwhile spending money on medical research? We couldn't survive without it now. Everything in our society is dependent at some
and
point
it's still less
on
than
communication.
A
yet there are some who complain that we are ignoring very important problems of starvation and ill-educated masses and pervasive epidemic-like diseases. Instead, we're spending money on something as fatuous and as fantastic as a voyage into space. We should be spending it on immediate and emergency human needs.
I don't think it's an either or, and
I
think
either,
that every penny that is spent on research in this area leads back to improving our own condition.
Probably
on Earth.
Even has medical payoffs among others.
Oh gosh, yes,
everything does.
The medical studies
towards
in
education.
Space. And education, but also we track agriculture so much better now and weather so much better because of space-based observation.
Comes that moment of truth where we pause for some commercial messages and then a quick update on the news, and then we will return to Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens. We will be going to the phones and to the email in about 10 or 12 minutes. So here's an open invitation to anyone who wants to pose a question or give us a report from outer space, for that matter. The phone lines are now open, 591-7200, the number, 591-7200. And if you are listening to us at some greater distance, if not yet from Mars, if you're, say, in Sao Paulo or in Sydney or, for that matter, waking up quite early in Baghdad and you want to reach us, the best way to do it would be via email, the email address, extension720@tribune.com. Extension720 as one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200. I propose that we go back again, almost back 100 years. I'm not quite sure when H.G. Wells wrote The War of the Worlds. Do you know?
1897.
Oh, it's even more than 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was a great representation of conflict between us and the beings of Mars, who were more potent and more powerful.
Yes, advanced and...
more advanced.
What was it? Gazing on Earth with envious eyes, because their planet was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the clash of two cultures.
And they came in their great machines,
giant
tripods
which to crush
stalk
us.
Across the stalk across all of the Earth and conquer us and destroy us. And then you remember, of course, that great representation of, drawn directly from the Wells novel, done by the other Wells, by Orson Welles.
Ah, yes.
The broadcast, I believe it was 1939, wasn't it?
39, yes.
Or 38.
What was that?
The war had not yet begun.
Not for the United States. The war was going on in Europe.
No, I think not.
No?
I think it was just before it had begun.
Just before.
I think the year is 38. I could be wrong. Do you have it in your book?
I think you do. Because there had been invasions.
My producer, Maggie Burnt, tells me 1938. She's just checked it out.
Yes, 1938.
We bow to
Maggie.
Yeah. Now, I've got a little surprise for you and for our listeners. The two Wellses, H.G. Wells and Orson Welles, get together almost by accident. They're both in, I think it's Houston, Texas, one particular week in 1941. And they're brought together on a radio program. And here is at least a portion of their discussion. It begins with an announcer from the local station explaining that the two of them are in town. And then we hear the conversation.
Wonderful. What a treat.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Charles C. Shaw speaking. KTSA is honored this evening by the presence in our studios of two great men, the Honorable H.G. Wells, world-famous British historian, author, and student of world affairs, and Mr. Orson Welles, the genius of stage, screen, and radio. This is the first time that Mr. H.G. Wells and Mr. Orson Welles have appeared together. In fact, they met for the first time only yesterday here in San Antonio. But this is not the first time that their names have been linked. 2 years ago, Mr. Orson Welles adapted Mr. H.G. Wells' book, War of the Worlds, for radio purposes, and you know the rest. Revising the story somewhat, Mr. Orson Welles depicted an invasion of the United States by men from Mars. Although he explained it numerous times during the program that it was fictitious, the country at large was frightened almost out of its wits. Men called radio stations offering to enlist against the Martians. Others were panic-stricken. The realism of the production, frightening though it was a tribute to Mr. Orson Welles' genius. And thus the name of Welles, H-G-W-E-L-L-S, and Orson W-E-L-L-E-S, became linked. Mr. H.G. Wells, in the opinion of many, is the world's most famous man of letters. He has come to San Antonio to address the United States Brewers Association, and Mr. Orson Welles is here for a town hall forum address Wednesday. In this meeting of great minds, I feel rather inconspicuous, and the less I have to say, the better you listeners will like it. But first, could I interest you gentlemen in a discussion of Mr. Orson Welles' broadcast of Mr. H.G. Wells' book, The War of the Worlds?
You're turning the meeting over to us, sir?
I am, for the moment.
He's turning it over to us. Well, I've had a series of the most delightful experiences since I came to America. But the best thing that has happened so far is meeting my little namesake here, Orson. I find him the most delightful carrier. He carries my name and an extra E that I hope he'll drop sooner or later. See no sense in it. And I've known his work before he made this sensational Halloween spree. Are you sure there was such a panic in America, or wasn't it your Halloween fun?
I think that's the nicest thing that a man from England could possibly say about the man from Mars. Well, Mr. Hitler made a good deal of sport of it, you know. Actually spoke of it in the great Munich speech, you know. And there were floats in Nazi parades.
Not much else to say.
That's right. Not much else to say. And it's supposed to show the corrupt condition and decadent state of affairs in democracies that the War of the Worlds went over as well as it did. I think it's very nice of Mr. Wells to say that not only I didn't mean it, but the American people didn't mean it.
That was our impression in England. We had articles about it, and people said, have you never heard of Halloween in America when everybody pretends to see ghosts?
Well, there was some excitement caused. I really can't belittle the amount that was caused, but I think that the people got over it very quickly, don't you?
What kind of excitement? Mr. H.G. Wells wants to know if the excitement wasn't the same kind of excitement that we extract from a practical joke in which somebody puts a sheet over his head and says, boo, I don't think anybody believes that that individual is a ghost, but we do scream and yell and rush down the hall. Mm-hmm. And that's just about what happens.
That's a very excellent description.
You aren't quite serious in America yet. You haven't got the war right under your chins, and the consequence is you can still play with ideas of terror and conflict.
Do you think that's good or bad?
It's a natural thing to do until you're right up against it.
So it ceases to be a game.
And then it ceases to be a game.
Well, now, here's a thought. Some of Mr. H.G. Wells' writings are termed fantastic, and a few years ago, well might they have been conceived such. The shape of things to come, which told of a long internecine war, was such a fantasy. But, Mr. Orson Welles, do you think that it's so fantastic in view of today's events?
It certainly is not so fantastic, and the one question that Mr. Wells has spoken of, not only in the shape of things to come, but has hinted at or directly prophesied such a state of affairs following a wasting war and a return to a feudalism from which the world would find itself again. And today in Mr. Wells' lecture, he said quite the most interesting thing that I've heard in a long time. He said that he'd commenced just recently to ask himself if there was any reason why mankind should so emulate the phoenix and should so get itself out of its mess. He proposed a couple of solutions, but he did admit that there was a possible excuse for a gloomy point of view, mm-hmm. and that it would be good to be realistic about it and not to dismiss the gloomy point of view anymore. Perhaps the time had come to look ahead, since the future, Mr. Wells's future, which we've always adored and never really understood, is suddenly upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are living right now in that famous H.G. Wells future, which we all knew about.
Now, before we get away from this microphone, tell me about this film of yours that you've been producing. You're a producer, aren't you? You're art director, you're everything.
Well, Mr. Wells...
What's the film called?
It's called Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, yes. Not C-A-I-N.
No, K-A-N-E. And this Kane. Is, of course, the kindest and most gracious possible thing to do. Mr. Wells is making it possible for me to do what in America is spoken of as a plug. And he understands
do
the fine old American...
I don't understand these words, yes.
You understand the value, however. Mr. Wells wants me to tell you that I have made a motion picture, and he is kind enough to ask me a leading question concerning it.
I'm looking forward to it.
Very kind, sir. It's a new sort of motion picture with a new method of presentation and a few new technical experiments, a few new methods of telling a picture, not only from the point of view of writing, but of showing it.
If I don't misunderstand you completely, I think there'll be a lot of jolly good new noises in it.
I hope so. Jolly good new noises are what the motion pictures could well afford these days. I hope you're right, and I hope there are some jolly good new noises. I can think of nothing more desirable than motion picture. I'm off for some
really
good new noises.
And that is just about the end of it. It's interesting. I was just checking my own memory on the Internet. Wells was born in 1866. He died in 1946, 5 years after this conversation. His last book was titled Mankind at the End of Its Tether. He had become completely depressed through the war and beyond about the future of mankind. He foresaw, I think, nuclear immolation or something like that. So whatever optimism he's trying to muster there, as Orson Welles says in the speech that he heard H.G. Wells give the day before, he was already painting a rather dire prospect.
Yes, and that gloomy view, and saying that it had to be entertained.
I remember there's a quote from H.G. Wells, which is chilling, and he said, if one wishes to imagine the future of humans, picture a boot grinding into a face forever,
remember
that it's forever.
Yeah. But one can argue, and it has been argued, I even read some quotes earlier, that our salvation requires, our salvation as a species, as a race, requires that we get out into space.
We have
to. Do you both
to.
Agree with that?
Yes.
Absolutely.
General argument?
Absolutely. Just look at the geological history of Earth. We've been hit with 7 major extinction events since life created a fossil record. And it's just a matter of time before another major extinction event occurs.
The next one might wipe out not the dinosaurs, they're gone, but wipe out Homo sapiens.
But I think it's even more than the need. I think it's the want.
Yeah.
I think we would go no matter what. Even if we were living in a paradise, we would go. Because I think, as Carl Sagan said, we're wanderers. I think we're drawn to explore.
Yeah. And you are stirring up a great deal of interest. We're going to pause for a quick round of commercials, then on to the phones and to the email. I see some of the people waiting on the phone lines have grown a little bit cynical or skeptical and abandoned us, but others are still there. But that means that if you've been trying to reach us and hitting the busy signal, we've now got a few lines cleared. So, 591-7200, the number, 591-7200. And again, if you want to reach us via the Internet, particularly if you're listening over the Internet and want to reach us, I should have said via email, the email address, extension720@tribune.com, directly onto your contributions, whether by email or by phone, after these words. And we return to Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens, who, together with Brian Weirhead, are the authors of the new book, Going to Mars, the stories of the people behind NASA's Mars missions, past, present, and future. Simon & Schuster, the publishers, 591-7200 is our number, and here is the first caller. Good evening.
Hello there. I'm an advocate, very strong advocate of Carl Sagan's Cosmos theories, and I found it interesting. One of the things that Sagan brought up was that even if man can travel at the speed of light many times over, the Earth is still remaining 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So virtually, if we could go to where we wanted to go, when we'd come back, there would be virtually nothing here to come back to. And I would be interested in their comments on that, because the concept of going that fast is awesome. And they said, you know, within 3 light years, you could be wherever you needed to be. But when you came back, Earth would not be here.
Well, it depends on how far you've been away and how fast you've been moving, obviously.
I think if you're traveling faster than the speed of light, like Star Trek or Starship Enterprise, the idea is you can go to another planet and come back within a reasonable period of time, a couple of months. If you're traveling at relativistic speeds, if there was some way to get a spaceship up to, 0.9 the speed of light, definitely, if you took 5 years to get to another star, spent a year there and came back, I believe at 0.9, almost 1,000 years would have gone by on Earth. So certainly everything you knew would be gone.
And that's the basis for an almost endless supply of time paradox science fiction stories.
That's right.
The twin paradox, and also yes. Planet of the Apes.
Yes, indeed. 591-7200. The number. We'll be back to the phones in an instant, I promise. But I should make very clear to our listeners, you are both science fiction writers. You've done a vast amount of that sort of work yourselves.
Oh, yes.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. Both as co-authors and as separate authors.
Well,
actually, Gar and I are a writing team, and for science fiction, we entered that field together.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we have a new, what we would call science fiction, what our publisher calls mainstream fiction, Free Fall, which is our new thriller, which is on the stands now, which is a bit like Going to Mars. It's based on the next race to the moon. It takes place on Space Station and the shuttle.
And is that not the sequel to your earlier book, Icefire?
Icefire, yes, that's correct.
Which got a lot of attention and a lot of...
yes, it did very well.
A lot of positive commentary.
Yep.
Including strong commendation from Stephen King.
Yes. We called it the best suspense novel of its type since The Hunt for Red October, and I think that bumped the sales up quite a bit.
Imagine you're remembering that quotation that precisely. Back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yeah, my question is related to the effects of private space ventures in terms of the morale of people who work at NASA and at JPL. Do they feel that it's a beneficial project? Do they feel it's going to be a brain drain, essentially? I just was wondering what their reaction was to some of these ventures.
They love it.
I think they're very positive.
Mm-hmm.
I think it simply expands the number of opportunities for people to go into space, and it also is something that's connecting with the public. It means the public might support it more.
Yeah, and definitely everybody we know at NASA is thrilled by private space exploration. NASA as an organization is thrilled by private space exploration because really they see themselves as the leading edge.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of the vision for space exploration, you can see that NASA wants to get out of the business of simply routinely taking things into orbit. The space shuttle fleet is scheduled to stop flying in 2010. I imagine it'll probably go a bit longer than that, but chances are it will be sold to a private company. And indeed, Space Station could be sold to a private company, and then NASA would concentrate.
They're the sole opportunity. They're the sole group now, institution that's doing it. This would actually solve a problem for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir, for an interesting call, and let us go to another interesting call. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Excellent program. I'd like to ask your guests what they think of the anomalies in the Cydonia region of Mars.
we actually have several pages.
Could we be talking about the face on Mars?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful example of how science is done. The face on Mars was first imaged by the Viking orbiters in 1975, and when the first photograph came down the day after it was shot by an orbiter, the first guy looking at the photograph said, hey, look at this, it's a face. And they had a press conference and they showed it to everybody, and everybody believed it was, of course, just light and shadow. And they figured that when the image was re-photographed under different lighting conditions, the face would disappear. About 30 days later, it was photographed again. The face was still there, though the lighting had changed.
And so it all began.
And so now what was wonderful is we have this testable hypothesis, which is the face was unlike a flying saucer or Bigfoot or something. The face was there. We knew exactly where it was. All that was required was to go back and photograph it in more detail. And that happened with the Mars Global Surveyor. And that pretty much to us and most scientists said, well, there it is. It's just a mesa that's eroded. And in the out-of-focus, low-resolution photographs from Viking, it has the illusion of a face, but it's not a face. And I have to say that there's no conspiracy going on at NASA, because there is nothing these guys would like better than to find a clear alien artifact, a fossil, something growing.
Because they know that that would loosen the public purse strings.
When they had the Allen Hills meteorite press conference, when President Clinton announced that there was an indication that there might be microfossils in this meteorite, NASA funding went up. And, you know, if there was a face on Mars, if the photographs had shown that that was an alien construction, there would be manned scientific base at Cydonia today.
By the way, what's the latest scientific consensus on that question of the meteorite and the microfossils?
There are still a number of objections. Some of the objections have been taken care of. I believe no scientist can object to the size of the microfossils now, because they have determined that it is possible to have living matter actually smaller, living organisms actually smaller than the microfossils are. And so it's up in the air, and I think everything it's sort of fueling the desire to get a really good microscope up to Mars, which will happen with the Mars Science Lab, and to get a Mars sample returned.
But if that turns out to be a microfossil of formerly organic matter, that is consistent, is it not, with the Crick hypothesis?
Yes. And the interplanetary seeding of life on Earth.
Yes, because because the evidence of the magnetite left behind matches similar organisms on Earth, so that would indicate perhaps common origin.
Let me read you an email. We've got a number of them that have arrived here, and here is the first of them. Could you discuss the concept mentioned very briefly at the beginning of Arthur Clarke's 3001 of terrestrializing, if that's a word, I just discovered it. I think he means terraforming.
Terraforming.
Venus. So terraforming or terrestrializing Venus by deflecting comets into it, thereby increasing the moisture so that the planet becomes, if not inhabitable, at least manageable. My high school English teachers would give me detention for that prolonged sentence.
Venus or Mars in 3001? Because, and certainly this is actually something...
This is actually something we just dealt with on Star Trek. Since we had joined the writing staff of Star Trek Enterprise this year, we have actually just been involved with the deflection of comets...
Into the polar ice caps of Mars
for this precise purpose.
You've done a show on that?
Yeah. Well, yes, we have.
A script on that. Yeah.
We have
Episode 21.
Episode 21, Terra Prime.
And again, this is like the warping of space. We know space expands because that's happening naturally. We know that terraforming happened to Earth. When Earth was a chemical planet, life arose, and the life that arose polluted the planet to create a thick atmosphere with oxygen in it, and then a whole new range of species evolved to make use of that oxygen. So it happens naturally. There are all sorts of ethical questions. If there's life on Mars, we're probably going to have to treat it like an endangered species. And
there will be great controversy about what we are able to do to a virgin territory and whether or not we have the right to treat Mars as an extension of Earth.
And Carl Sagan also raised the point that any society, any culture that has the technological ability to deflect a comet or an asteroid to, hit the Martian ice cap also has the ability to deflect it to hit Earth. And
this is the weaponization of space again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So fortunately, the technology to do all that is at least a century away, so we have time to think about
it. We also dealt with this in Star Trek. And, of course, the Verderon array was used as a weapon against Earth.
Okay. I was quizzing you on this before, namely your own background, mm-hmm. but I'm sure many of our listeners are curious about that. Let's take a moment or two before we go to some commercials, and then we'll mm-hmm. be back to the phones. How did the two of you get into this line of work?
We've gone back and forth between science fiction and science fact.
Mm-hmm.
And we began in science fact, working together, and we created a science and technology series to introduce children to grades one, two, and three.
Up in Canada, where you both come from.
Yeah. That's right, to science and technology.
And that was a 2-year, three-year project for us. We went all across Canada, taught sample lessons, dealt with all the ministries of education. And
we were exhausted, and we thought, surely there is a perhaps more fun way to be doing this. And we happened to go down to New York, and we saw a Star Trek movie, Star Trek IV, I believe it was.
That's right.
We came out with that, gee, I wonder if they do books. And we could do stories like that. And we called them up, and all they wanted to know was if we had an agent. We said yes, and they said, send us some ideas. We sent them three. They picked one, and that was the first science fiction book we wrote together.
And
what was this?
It was called Memory Prime, and it dealt with the existence of supercomputers and wondering why there were no alien or no
artificial intelligences
in Star Trek. In fact, we had computers that in their downtime composed runes, I believe.
The idea being that if you have true artificial intelligence, to use it in any manner is slavery. And so they had to be given their freedom. And then that was carried on by Next Generation.
After Star Trek, then we went back and forth. We created our own science fantasy series, The Chronicles of Galen Sword.
Mm-hmm.
We then we came down to the United States because we realized there was no snow.
In
Los Angeles. And when we came down here, the Paramount realized we were only 15 minutes away from them. And we ended up writing behind-the-scenes books about Star Trek, which then showed us how a television series went together. And as we did that, we then were writing more books about Star Trek, creating our own speculative fiction books.
We ended up actually going to Australia to be supervising producers on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World, a syndicated science fiction series.
Which was about scientists in the 1920s, mm-hmm. with 1920s science lost on a plateau.
And didn't you also do a series of Star Trek novels with Captain Kirk and
Spock? We've been working with Bill Shatner for 10 years.
A famous Canadian.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Another Canadian. Yeah. I didn't realize
that's right.
And later on this year, we have our ninth Star Trek novel with Bill is coming out, mm-hmm. sort of the further adventures of Captain Kirk, who really didn't die at the end of Generations. And actually new books about Kirk and Spock at the Academy as teenagers starting next year.
It's an exciting career.
It's fun.
And you've taken time to visit with, to hang around for a long time,
mm-hmm.
At JPL, and the outcome of that is this fine new book, Going to Mars, the stories of the people behind NASA's Mars missions, past, present, and future, just published by Simon & Schuster. We now have some space available on our phone board again. If you've been trying to reach us, make another try. If you're so inspired for the first time, move quickly, 591-7200, the number. 591-7200, and of course, on our email, there is virtual infinite space available, whatever virtual infinity means. And that address is extension 720 at tribune.com. We return to you and your questions and comments after this. And directly back to the phones, 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, Milton, your guests. First, I'd like to mention I am a big science fiction fan. I'm particularly fond of Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein. And one of the things, Heinlein has, of course, a number of stories that deal with the traveling into distant space. And I believe one of the things he talked about was being able to travel through the distant universes by going through what he referred to as folds in the universe, where, mm-hmm. in essence, it would be if you folded a napkin, and instead of going horizontally, you were able to fold it over so you can go vertically. Is there any scientific fact to that theory?
Supergravity. And there is, I'm trying to remember, there there is some concern that gravity, its power, it's so weak compared to the other major forces of the universe that there's some thought that some of that energy is being extended into other dimensions. And I have seen, I think in Scientific America, a diagram that looks like ribbon candy. And the idea is that gravity from our star is being is affecting the planets around it and affects the other stars in our galaxy, but also shoots up and down through this folded over space to affect other matter elsewhere. So this is
could easily be.
Yep.
Well, I guess the other question is, considering the just unbelievably vast distances that there are in the universe. I mean, all you can do is look at, you know, some of the photographs, and you talk about, you know, thousands of light years away. I mean, just, you know, as I said, unbelievably distant, you know, vast distances. First of all, I would have to think that just the laws of probability with the, just, you know, the, you know, Sagan's billions upon billions that he used to talk about stars, but considering, you know, like the stars really are like dust. On the sands of the beach, and I think it's very probable that there are worlds out there that that are similar to Earth and have the same environment that could create Earth. But realistically, with the distances being so internally vast, you know, I think the odds, my personal feeling is the odds of any of us meeting up are just infinitesimal.
Well, that's one possibility, but also just think what we've done in terms of engineering in our brief time on the planet.
Oh, I know. I mean, I'm 55, and in 1955, so 50 years ago, my family took a trip from New York City to Minnesota by train, and it took over 2 days to get to Minneapolis from New York City. And yeah, I mentioned that to my kids this evening, and they looked at me like I was from outer space.
Perhaps you are.
That is very true.
I firmly believe it's a question of engineering.
Engineering, but it certainly is extreme engineering, and unlikely in our lifetime. So at the moment, it still exists just in science fiction.
Yeah. Sir, thank you for the call.
Thank you. And may you live long and prosper.
May you survive and succeed.
Thank you.
All right. 591-7200 is the number. And some lines are available again, so if you want to reach us, move quickly. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Calling from Joliet. I have been a lifelong...
That's almost as far away as Andromeda.
Say what?
Never mind. Go ahead.
I've been a lifelong fan, watcher of Star Trek shows ever since I was 12 years old. And I was delighted to hear that you two folks were on the show today. Oh, I think you have done a fantastic job.
Thank you.
Of
revitalizing this series, at least creatively, but not in the ratings. I think you guys have done a fantastic job. But some reference was made to the writing that you folks have done, and I refer to the novels. I just finished reading Quicksilver, and it was a mile-a-minute thriller. That was after I read Ice Fire. And I'm just curious. I could see a movie in this book as I was reading it. What are the chances that some of your work will be made in the film?
There has been interest because as we write them, they're visual to us as well, and we're in the moment with them. And there has been significant interest. However, these are ones that require almost the budget of NASA to make. And there are only about three studios that can make our books. Yeah. I hope you're going to go on and look for Freefall, which is the story that takes place after Ice Bar.
I'm aware of it, and I've seen it in paper. My other question is, I'm aware that Star Trek Enterprise has been canceled. I think that's a real shame. I'm also aware that there has been an effort to rescue it. Mm-hmm. Do you have a progress report on that or any upcoming Star Trek ventures?
Absolutely none. It seems pretty clear that UPN and Paramount have made up their mind to cancel the series, but check the, I believe it's saveenterprise.com, and they're the folks behind this raising. Last we heard, it was $3.2 million they had raised.
I heard about that.
Which is amazing.
Watch the six episodes still to come, because the second last one is the one where we are involved in terraforming Mars.
Yes, I heard that.
With Peter Weller.
Previously.
Yeah.
in the future, as the Star Trek franchise continues, I hope you people are right there in the middle of its creativity. You folks have done a fantastic job of revitalizing this franchise.
Well, thank you very much.
Really proud of your work.
Yay,
well,
thanks.
Thank you. It really was our pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Now that we all fully appreciate one another, it's time to pause just briefly for our last round of commercials. Then directly back to your calls and your emails to Judith and Garfield Reeves-Stevens after these words. And directly back to Judith and Garfield Reeves-Stevens. The phone lines are available. If you want to call, move quickly, 591-7200. But I think I want to read you some interesting emails that I've got in front of me. Here's one. Lays out a very interesting thesis. Most of the early exploration of our own planet was based on economic incentives from ancient people crossing the land bridge between Asia and Alaska in search of better hunting grounds to the voyages of Columbus and others in search of shortcuts for trade and commerce. One could argue that going to the moon was a fluke, an offspring of the Cold War, rather than exploration for the sake of exploration. Without an economic incentive for staying, we stopped sending humans to the moon after just 6 landings. What economic incentive would justify the astronomical costs of sending humans to the red planet? And without such justification, wouldn't a program to send humans to Mars wind up like Apollo, with a collection of rocks and little else to show for the taxpayers who would be asked to underwrite those costs?
The science report.
Man has an interesting argument.
Yes. Oh.
And it's an argument that's raised often. I'm just thinking of Neil Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium, who brings that up, but he always puts them together as economics and politics. And he said all exploration has been funded by that. So
one or the other.
It likely could be a political one, again, that would drive us to Mars faster.
Definitely. Going to the moon was not scientific exploration. That was a way for the United States and the Soviet Union to have a war without involving weapons, and to prove their technical prowess against each other.
To say my missile is bigger than yours.
Exactly. And the United States won, and that was the end of it. And it was, as they called it, a flags and footprint mission. Mm-hmm. Going to Mars, there is no specific economic advantage to having sending people to Mars. It does become a political thing, and that's why it's being spread out under this vision for space exploration over 15, 20, 25 years to make it affordable. What it will do is build a huge economic advantage in the technical engineering scientific infrastructure of the United States. And we have to look ahead to the year 2020, when there is the potential of another Cold War. And this is something the State Department and the Pentagon look at as China becomes a superpower and a peer competitor to the United States. With China sending its own Tychonaut into orbit, and sometime this year perhaps sending 2 into orbit, that is a way for them to demonstrate their technological prowess without involving weapons.
How curious. This email has just come in. What do your guests think about China's space program, as well as the U.S. military's space projects? I have read that if China lands a man on Mars, case in international law will allow them to declare it as their territory alone. Is this true?
No.
No.
They wouldn't be able to defend their claim. And now, I don't believe China has signed the Space Act, or... There is an international treaty in which I believe China has signed, in which the nations of the world have agreed that none of the planets, the moons, the asteroids can be claimed. Mm-hmm. You can only lay claim to the actual territory that your base occupies.
Like Antarctica.
Like Antarctica.
Mm-hmm. So another email. I was surprised at how limited was the media's attention to the recent landing on the Saturn moon. I arrived at my office the morning following the landing, and there was little talk about this landing. I am 38 years old, and I recall the first space shuttle launch being the talk of our nation for weeks. I would be grateful if your guests would comment on why general public interest may be lacking in these projects.
There were no people on Titan. And that is the another great reason for sending people to Mars, because people will pay attention to NASA at that moment. But what was it? It was when John Glenn went up in the shuttle. Mm-hmm. That was the most watched space launch since the Apollo program, Apollo 11. Yeah.
Because he was a 78-year-old senator who had also been our first astronaut up into the...
Yeah, but there was a personal story.
There was a human interest story attached to it.
So the landing on Titan was
robotics
incredible.
Robotics does not capture the public's imagination in the same way. Mm-hmm. However, when it's something involving, say, the pictures that come back from the Hubble, mm-hmm. people respond. Mm-hmm. But robotics, there's nothing mm-hmm. right now.
Mm-hmm. But we've had a good deal of interest in the two Mars explorers mm-hmm. that are still poking around on the surface right now.
Yep. Yeah. Oh. When they landed and the fact that they were successful at first, there was a little bit of trouble with the computer mm-hmm. on Spirit, which they solved.
I put in mind though, Gar, when we went down. Do you remember going down to Santa Monica when we saw them bringing out NASA brought out a group of rovers and showed different kinds of rovers on the sands of Malibu,
of
Santa Monica. To the public, and the public were all gathered around them as if they were at Muscle Beach looking at the rovers. And one of the little rovers, and I'm using the word little deliberately, because one of the little rovers fell over and the crowd went, aw. And
the
a lot
little
of
ones were cute.
They were cute, uh-huh. and people anthropomorphized them. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was the same feeling when Sojourner went up. People looked upon it as brave little Sojourner
exactly
up there alone on Mars.
Exactly
and school children cried when told that it would be going forever in a little circle trying to contact Earth, and it would be in the dark and alone. And I have a feeling, even with Spirit and Opportunity having more impersonal names, people have actually looked at the rovers and seen them more like R2-D2.
Yep.
And something from Star Wars.
Uh-huh.
So if that's a form of robotics that they can identify with.
Mm-hmm. One more email coming up. I'm rather lengthy, but worth going through. This is from a fellow in Las Vegas. And he says, I have been interested in space since I first read Asimov some 25 years ago. I've also been a supporter of programs such as SETI, At Home, AMSAT, the Planetary Society, the XPRIZE, etc. I strongly believe that space colonization is incumbent upon the human race. Staying here on Earth is simply inviting disaster, either at our own hands or that of the cosmos. I also strongly believe that even as open-minded as exobiologists may be, their views of extraterrestrial life are still far too restricted. Why must life be based on the chemical processes of carbon or silicon? Given the world of digital intelligence, a sentient, replicating, intelligent computer program mm-hmm. could not be classified as carbon or silicon, but would fall into the category of life. I humbly believe that we are being far too narrow in our search for extraterrestrial life. We are simply babies dressed in diapers playing in our sandbox, looking in our backyard for other children.
Yep. I think it's a very good point. And aren't they even using computer models where set in motion, computer models can mm-hmm. create what you would think would be a form of life?
Yep.
And they've been used in evolutionary studies.
Mm-hmm. NASA faced this problem in the 60s when they were designing the life detection experiments to be used eventually on Viking. And the problem they faced was, if it's not life as we know it, we can't define it, so we can't build the instruments to look for it. So you're right. We're you know, kids in the playground looking for other kids. We know what life as we know it is, so that's what we're looking for. And beyond that, definitely the offspring of humanity that goes to the stars is probably going to be a human silicon, a new species that we create.
You really think so?
Yeah.
Born of woman or born of a biological process or constructed in a laboratory?
Probably biological, mm-hmm. but enhanced. Mm-hmm. We know what we're doing with genetic engineering now. Mm-hmm. We will make our own replacements.
There is a direction.
Mm-hmm. And those replacements, I believe, are the ones that can be engineered to, if we can't beat Einstein, if we can't beat relativity, they are the ones that are going to be switched off, go on a 1,000-year voyage, and switch back on.
Of course, there's an old plot that's been available for a long time. It's certainly represented in the Talmudic tales of the Golem. In more recent time, that is about 100 years ago, mm-hmm. is represented in something I'm sure you're aware of, Karel Kapek's
R.U.R.,
Rossum's Universal Robots.
Yes.
Theme there is that man invents a life-imitating mm-hmm. mechanical form which grows more and more mm-hmm. lifelike mm-hmm. and ultimately revolts against man and takes him over and maybe even destroys him.
Yeah,
I can certainly see the scenario.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think it will be like iRobot the movie where we actually create physical objects that then take over from us, but I believe it will probably be more of a merging where we will simply improve because that's what humans do.
What is this merged human silicon creature that you have in mind? I mean, you mean just amplified in strength, say, or in reasoning, or what?
Strength, reasoning, speed, access to information.
And amplified by virtue of what? Built-in computer elements?
Built-in computer elements, definitely. Though they wouldn't be computers as we recognize them. We're not going to have chips implanted in our
head. A little bit like the governor of California in his earlier in his earlier incarnation. It is a bit like Terminator.
A bit like that. I would go along with that. Not definitely a robot, but there are things. It's all the process of evolution. And now we're at a point where we can, 50 years from now or even now, guide our own evolution. And once we have that ability,
actively doing so.
Yep.
It'll be instead of Homo sapiens, Homo enhanced sapiens.
It will be the next stage.
Yep. I would go along with that.
A fascinating speculation. What are you two up to next?
At the moment, we are...
Alien fire.
We are writing about a fire beast that will be involving William Shatner, who's going to direct and star in a movie for the Sci-Fi Channel called Alien
Science.
Fire. Oh, but it involves science, and it involves all sorts of...
It's almost an homage to the great science fiction films of the 50s. Sort of it's a nice B... monster movie, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll be making that this summer.
And Shatner's going to play.
He's going to play.
He's going to direct it.
And we've been having a lot of fun developing the script with him.
That sounds wonderful. The new book that we've been drawing from, but it's far richer than we have been able to develop in this brief, all too brief time, is Going to Mars, the stories of the people behind NASA's Mars missions past, present, and future, by Brian Weirhead, Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens. And as we made clear at the beginning of the program, Reeves Stevens is hyphenated, the combination of the two original names of Mr. and Mrs. Reeves Stevens.